Hello, Ken. Welcome.
Hello, hello.
Hey, Ken. It's Jeff.
Hey, Jeff. How are you, buddy?
I'm good. How are you? Good to hear your voice.
Good to hear your voice, pal.
Hi, Ken. Diana's here on the line as well.
Ah, Di, how are you, dear?
I'm good. Other than the intractable fact of human, I'm really great.
Other than what?
The intractable fact of my humanness, I'm great.
Oh, oh, that damn thing. Oh, so you brought that, did you?
Yes, I did. I've drugged that along, unfortunately. We're really happy that you'll take time with us this morning, and we're getting ready for this event, and we're kind of enjoying the spirit of the old integral seminars when you used to come and inspire everybody so much. So we're really happy to be working with each other and also just to get some time with you. So thanks so much.
Oh, absolutely. I think it'll be delightful. I'm so glad that you guys started this event in general just to, you know, keep a certain spirit alive.
Yeah. Well, I just said to these guys, it's a little bit like we're moving from the ILP, from the integral life practice to the integral we practice.
And yeah.
So, you know, part of what, as you say, what we want to do is just, you know, start with some questions that we think will really help to shape things. So I think the first question I have, and I've got about six, and then, of course, you know, whatever you think is relevant beyond these questions.
Sure.
Do you have a time frame that you're working with today, Ken? You'd like to be off at a certain point to have another
90 minutes or so.
About 90 minutes. Okay, great. So I guess maybe just, this is very general, but, you know, one of the questions I posed on the blast that we sent out is, if we want to move into a deeper, genuine integral community, wherever that happens to be and whatever the physical or subtle or causal boundaries are around that ecosystem, you know, moving more deeply requires things of people in terms of, you know, just our togetherness. What questions do you think we should be asking ourselves in terms of moving more deeply into a, let's call it an enlightened we, this group?
Yeah, well, you know, the first thing, of course, I'm going to tend to frame this in integral theory terms, just because I, you know, one of the ways that I would do it. And what we're really talking about, of course, is all four quadrants evolve. And as a matter of fact, all dimensions in the universe continue to evolve. And they all do so, as far as I can tell. And the reason I use the word tetraprehension is that Whitehead sort of, you know, first set forth how he saw the moment-to-moment unfolding of the universe. And he was just describing it in a simple subject-object line. But I maintain the same thing occurs in all four quadrants. And the essence of it was that a new moment comes to be, and it's a subject. And mm-hmm. so it has prehension or proto-awareness or proto-consciousness. And the new subject prehends the previous moment. It mm-hmm. prehends the previous subject. And in prehending it or feeling it or knowing it, or being aware of it, it makes it an object.
Mm-hmm.
And so that object then, because it's prehended or embraced or included in the present moment, becomes part of the present moment, and that constitutes the past determination on the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
But then the present moment also has... Huh?
Go
it's
ahead.
Karma.
I was just reflecting. Yeah. Karma.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
But in addition to receiving the past and feeling the past and being aware of the past and incorporating the past, the present moment has a degree of novelty or creativity. And so it adds its novel, creative component to what it inherited from the past.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that novel creative component is just that. It's new. It's something that's genuinely emergent. It's something that genuinely hasn't been seen before. That could be something as simple as a new direction that a particle takes, or a new interaction with other particles, or it could be a real leap, like when atoms first came together to form molecules, or a truly staggering leap when molecules came together to form living cells.
Mm-hmm.
But that happened in one moment. One moment there was just a bunch of molecules, and in the very next moment there was a living cell.
Mm-hmm.
So that addition of novelty or newness is then what the present subject does. And then mm-hmm. it passes the whole bundle on to the next moment, which arises mm-hmm. as a subject, prehends the previous moment, making it then an object, and so on. So there's transcend and include, transcend and include, transcend and include. And that's going on in all four quadrants. And so what we're looking at as we're focusing on the we is something that is happening in all four quadrants, which is that there's a moment of newness
mm-hmm.
that is where, if any transformation is going to occur, or if any increase in truth or goodness or beauty or reality or depth or complexity or consciousness is going to occur, it's going to occur in that moment of adding the novelty, of adding the newness. And so when we started, looking at transformation, in sort of the first round of it, we tended to focus, of course, on individual transformation, or the upper left, or the eye. And, of course, that's still utterly important. I mean, we still need to have awakened, enlightened, caring, authentic individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Without those, the we that will form will be pretty rotten, and nothing but a version of the herd mentality and the tyranny of the majority and all of the horrible things that mob mentalities have a tendency to do. So like they're saying about Egypt, the great protesters, rotten Democrats. So what we're doing now is we're starting to focus on the we. There's a whole mixed bag of motivations that's going on there. Of course, some of them are very, very good and very high, and some of them are less than noble. And in a certain sense, it's got kind of a faddish quality to it. But it's been something that has been, I mean, this what I call the miracle of the we, of course, has been a part of integral theory since the beginning of the quadrants.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so since there has been a focus on we practices lately, the various questions that come up essentially focus, not totally, but essentially focus on that space of newness, that creation of novelty. What, in order to make a greater we, has to be added to the previous we
mm-hmm.
in order okay. to get a fuller, higher, more transformed, more virtuous, better we space? Nobody undertakes these we practices that I'm aware of to become less than they are.
Right.
They're all in it to become better than they are, to become yeah. greater in some degree, to answer questions that we don't have answers for. Now, of course,
and
this
to honor,
can be done in,
honor our evolutionary communion. We have this huge communion we've inherited, and we're going to keep
exactly. And because we have become conscious of it, It's now become a moral issue, which is not only are we evolution become conscious of itself, we become evolution that now has a moral obligation to be the best evolution that it can be.
Right, now that we're involved.
Exactly. And now that it's conscious, and now that it's in our awareness, it's not something that we can now turn away from,
right.
Nor is it something that we can just let happen, you know, to happenstance. Because we're intentional, and because we care, and now because we're aware, then we have to say, okay, what practices can I do to make the best possible I that I can be? But also, what practices would help the we spaces that we're in? And what practices are going to help convert any of those creative ideas into actual material institutions in the lower right, for example? And if we don't, we find, of course, that all of these are mutual. If lower right institutions, changes in climate warming or changes to help with terrorism or changes to help with economic meltdown or so on, if we don't also have changes in the left-hand quadrants, changes in consciousness and culture that will support those institutions die. There has to be, all four quadrants have to stick. Something has to be done in all four quadrants in order to have these advances become a part of ongoing reality and ongoing evolution. So part of the questions, if we're focusing on the we space, is, okay, what is it that we can do? What exactly are the steps that we can undertake that in some degree can be taught? Now,
Well, I just said are replicated, you know, to replicate.
Well, yeah, exactly. And the point, yeah. Particularly at first, and when we're moving in areas that Terry refers to as trans-rhetorical, then we can't have, you know, some fixed aim or goal or some fixed focus in our mind. I mean, we have to be much more open and allow what's going to come up, because that's where a lot of the newness and the freshness and the creativity will be. But if we can't repeat it, if we can't show others how to make a greater we space, this is just going to be an event that we had one evening and it was great for us, and then never happened again. What was the point? So we don't want, you know, educational or rhetorical or goal-driven aims, I don't think, to be part of an immediate we practice. But at the same time, we want to sort of keep, you know, ongoing track of what helps and what doesn't help. Of what works and what doesn't work to help this we go forward. And of course, this is important because if we look at the we space on the world scene, then depending on how you measure it, you know, somewhere between 60 and 70% of the world's population is at ethnocentric or lower levels of development and altitude. And so the question is, well, what altitude of we space are we going to focus on? Generally, if it's in the integral community, it's focusing on something around second tier, which is fine. There are types of we spaces that are all types of we spaces are dependent upon the altitude of the individuals in the we space. A group of people at red is entirely different than a group of people at turquoise.
So we can presume that there are that that just like with the individual and generally like culture, that there are structure stages and there are markers of what engagement looks like at different levels. So from the outside, we should be able to observe certain things in how we're interacting.
Well, I think so. I think what it means on balance is that we acknowledge that we are going into these practices with certain goals in general.
Mm-hmm.
Terry, for example, indicated that in most of the groups that he had looked at and summarized, particularly, for example, an integral trans rhetorical practice has a higher transformational intent. And it has a purpose of mutual uplift and deepening more than persuasion or education, certainly at the beginning. And I think that's fine. I think we have to acknowledge that there are either explicit or implicit goals that we have with these we practices. As I said, I've never seen anybody go into a we practice with a goal of becoming lesser than they are. So that means that they have a goal of becoming greater in some sense. And now some of these groups will define what they mean by greater. So David Bohm means coming up with solution to world crises. Andrew Cohen means directly downloading the evolutionary urgency for consciousness and culture. And Otto Scharmer and the U process is to get in touch with creativity. Thomas Hubel is working on a higher we without a them. Now, I happen to think that there's advantages to all of those. I don't think any one of them is, you know, the only way to do it or the correct way to do it.
And what
the we space,
exactly?
Like any space, I space, its space is enormously complex and has an enormous number of factors that go into making it. And we're not even aware of all of them. Even with all the humanities studies that we've done and so on, there are still ways that language, for example, and semiotics and signifiers and reference and so on are forming meaning spaces in ways that we're just not even aware of. So we certainly have to keep an open mind about that. But the point is that whatever type of we practice we're doing, that however we suspend our initial goals or aims and attempt to say things like, you know, we don't want to get in this in a didactic fashion. We don't want to do this as an abstract third person, you know, analytic engagement. All of that is absolutely fine because it means that we're being more explicit about what our actual goals are in this particular we practice.
Right.
And every we practice will be in some ways different. It'll have different goals, different aims. What it means by greater will be different. And what I'm saying is all of that's fine. But whoever's doing that particular kind of practice should also, in some point of their mind, or in some way, have in effect a recording secretary who's keeping track of what works and what doesn't work, so that we do start to learn how to do these various we spaces better and better and better. Otherwise, again, you know, what's the point? Why go in and have a we space experience that will never, ever, ever be repeated by anybody?
You know, Ken, I was able to participate in a very rich, small kind of a pilot project with Stefan and Miriam Martineau, and we brought in Dustin and Olin Gunnlaugsson and Andrew Venezia, and we kind of were workshopping principles. We identified that the very first thing that's necessary for anything to happen, in addition to the adequacy issues that I talked about in my paper, which you've commented on when we talked before, is to build a field of trust that's really, really strong.
Right.
And that you may not be able to even do We Space practice if you don't have a basis for that. Like your first practice is to get to a place where there's enough trust that you can even begin. And some occasions when people might want to practice We Space simply are only going to be trying to establish enough trust so that, you know, something can begin. That can be a high hurdle for some groups.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
It makes sense because what many of these We Spaces are doing is also asking people to, in essence, sort of, drop any facades, drop as many defense mechanisms as they can, be as naked and as exposed and as vulnerable as they possibly can be. And of course, that's difficult enough to do in itself for most people. And to do it with a group of people, staring at you is even harder. And to do it with people you don't trust is impossible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense to me.
Exactly. Now, once we have established enough trust, it seems to me that the core of the practice is a witnessing capacity. There has to be an awareness function, but then it also has to be a dropping of a kind of subject-object remove and abstraction and a drawing into the living moment, because the newness, the emergence that makes the We Space alive, such that the We Space is an incubator for real innovation, is always going to arise out of the livingness of the moment, the potential for emergence that lies in that. And so it's a rather intense, active, and almost ecstatic meditative practice to return attention to the aliveness of the living moment in the place of contact with one another.
Right. And we talked about that in our conversation we had, and I said that one of the reasons that I think We Space practices are becoming attractive is the inherent structure of a we doesn't have a dominant monad. In other words, it doesn't have an I. It has what I call a nexus or nexus agency. And that nexus is intersubjective. And that literally is what a we is. A we isn't a super I. In no group does a single I form that controls all the group members, the way that I have a single I that if I tell my arm to rise, my arm will rise and every atom, molecule, and cell in it will rise with it. That's 100% control, and that's what Whitehead called dominant monad. But no group ever has a dominant monad. There's an intersubjective nexus. And that's just what it means, is subtract all individual subjects, and what you have left is their interaction, or the field, or the network that they're forming. And so to the extent that we focus on a we space, then to just that extent, we're not focusing on an I space. And so the we space is, in some sense, is already a step in transcending the separate self or I. It's already a move in that direction. And then what's being circulated through that we space is, of course, is the single ultimate true self. And that's kind of the glue of this intersubjective nexus. But it is being, you know, each individual does have a different perspective on that. But the intersubjective field itself is a fairly unified network. And it's a network that is intersubjective, not subjective. So the subject-object duality has a tendency to be transcended whenever we enter a genuine we space. And so that's going to allow and help whatever witnessing is present to actually shift into non-dual awareness and not just be a radical subjectivity or absolute subjectivity. And so that's one of the advantages of the we space right there, is this intersubjective nexus.
Mm-hmm. It's a moment.
Yeah, Ken, this is Jeff, and if I may, this happens with me with you all the time. You describe something, and I feel like I just moved into a new territory. And I think of the times when I'm even just with a group of friends sitting around in my living room with a glass of wine or whatever.
Right.
To the degree that I can actually have some awareness of the group itself,
right,
and all of the intersubjective nexus that's going and moving and shaking, instead of in my smaller self moments, I'm contracted around myself and my opinion,
right,
and my point of view.
Right.
And but to the degree that I can be aware of all of it, it just raises the vibration and raises my own vibration and, sort of effectiveness in showing up.
It does, doesn't it? I mean, that's why I keep referring to it as the miracle of we, because it's absolutely astonishing that two separate minds, even though they're joined by big mind, but the two separate minds can actually come together and reach a point where each of them will say, I understand what you mean. There's that inner subjectivity that is, again, it's not just a super I, but it does have a life of its own. It is a we that can't be reduced to either I. And so to just that extent, it's beyond an individual I. To just that extent, you're involved in something bigger. And of course, whenever you're involved in something bigger, then you're less involved in something smaller. and therefore, suffering is reduced, and pain is reduced, and life anxiety is reduced. And that's what we feel when we're, in a group of friends. It's not just, a joy and a happiness, but there's a safety and a sense of security and a sense of, sort of being home kind of feeling about it. And that's all inherent in that inner subjective field that by nature is beyond any particular subject, or certainly between any particular subject. And so if we can have enlightened subjects, which we can, and a we space in some sense is a greater space, then why not have an enlightened we? What would that be like? That would be, extraordinary. That would be mind-boggling. That would be earth-shaking. And that's, of course, what we're talking about. There's when people say the new Buddha is the Sangha, again, a whole lot of different motives for that. A large part of it is just nothing but the green stage mouthing off its particular platitude, that everybody's egalitarian and nobody can actually be a Buddha they're better than anybody else and all of that sort of nonsense. But there's also a much deeper meaning, and I think deeper even than the original Buddhists meant it. But that there really is an enlightened form of Sangha. There's an enlightened form of we, where Buddha mind is the fundamental currency of every subject in that intersubjective field. And when that happens, then the newness that's being added to each moment becomes infinitely new and fresh and liberated and transcending and freeing and fulfilling. And it's a type of food you can't get any place in a single eye space. And so that's the attraction of it. And that, of course, is why human beings are ridiculously social people.
One of the things we're doing here, and you talked about earlier that, you know, getting better at we spaces helps us deal with people at all stages of development and throughout the world.
Right.
That's undoubtedly true. And what we're doing at the Integral Living Room is, so, you know, what's Integral We Space? What's actually new here? And how does that push off of green? Yes.
Hey, Jeff, can I ask you to just bookmark that for a second? Because I want to go into that, but I just want to do one clarifying point in terms of integral theories. So it seems like Ken, that the pre-trans fallacy is actually important here, because giving up the I can be regressive in terms of the whole term fascism. So part of what we're trying to sort out, particularly like in my case where I've inherited a lineage that does have a single monad, and that monad is the Zen master, or in Andrew's case, Andrew. And so there's the liberty to feel a we because you've got this one person who's actually organizing the space. So there's stability to feel the Buddha mind, but then it's prone to corruption, as we know, or it's prone to abuse, or it's prone to excess, or whatever it is. So the pre-trans fallacy is like when Jeff talks about dinner, he's talking about mainly extending ourselves, but somehow the I actually still gets to have a place, just if for no other reason to check yourself on your ethics periodically.
Right.
So when we talk about, now to go to Jeff's question about what is an integral we space, I would submit that an integral we space has a lot of fluidity in terms of identification so that we can move between a group of individuals to an intersubjective space, to a transcendent space, that includes an individual component. Maybe in one moment it's highly emotional and we're navigating emotional texture. Maybe in the next moment it's purposive and we're organizing around a shared vision. And maybe in the next moment it really has to do with what is each person in this moment going to contribute, so that there's massive flexibility of identity with a shared ground of transcendent that people can either access or just doesn't disappear. That's sort of from an interior description. I think Jeff's question about what is integral we space, how might that be different than belonging to a cult? Or just participating in a democracy, which we all know we've all done for many years.
Right. Well, the simplest of several ways to go about that, the simplest is that each moment is a synthesis or a balancing of all four quadrants. So you want to be careful getting into a we space that has absolutely no eyes at all, for just that reason, because the we space is still going to be dominated by a particular altitude and by particular characteristics. So you can get in a wee space, for example, that let's just say theoretically there are 10 people and 9 of them are turquoise and 1 of them is red. And then all of a sudden the whole group starts doing an Andrew Cohen thing where evolutionary intelligence seems to descend on the group and sort of take over everybody and replace their individual eyes with this evolutionary urgency of the group we. That we, when it talks, will still be talking through individual minds. And so it will still be colored to some extent by the individual mind. Even though the subjective feeling is, I'm not saying it, this greater intelligence is saying it. Well, that's fine, except if you're turquoise and this greater intelligence is speaking through you, it's going to come out turquoise. When that red fellow speaks, it's not going to come out turquoise. It's going to come out red. Now, he thinks he's part of the same identical we. But as a matter of fact, he's only partly part of the we. And there's also the I component that is still present in any we, because all four quadrants are always present, no matter how much one can be focused on or however much one is coming to the fore at a particular point. All four of them are still there and are still implicitly or explicitly molding the experience of the present moment. So an integral I space is an integral we space. The reason we call it an integral we space and not an integral I space or an integral it space is that the focus is temporarily on forming a greater we and on learning and exploring new ways of making a greater we. And so that's where our focus is. But the eyes will still be present. And that's why, you know, these are taken care of in Carrie's, you know, list of, you know, almost a dozen things that have to be adequate in order to be able to form anything that is an exciting and enlightening we space. 10 red people aren't going to do it. So Gary says they, you know, at least have to be sort of exit orange and exit green and better even teal and, of course, better yet, turquoise. But there are all prerequisites that the eyes in a particular we have to meet if that we is going to be something that we would then, you know, excitedly call an integral we. And one of the things that would be present is the individual morals of individual I. And those would be implicit in each individual in the we space. And should that we space start to violate a particular moral in a grievous fashion, like, well, let's go out and lynch that guy. Now, almost all lynchings are done by a mob. No lynchings are done by individuals. There's another force that comes into being in any inner subjective field. One of them, of course, is a force of transcendence. But another is a force of regression. mobs will do things that individuals will never do. And I think Jane Lovinger, I'd mentioned, she had done some test where she found on average that groups of individuals acted on average two stages lower than the individuals themselves were at.
Wow.
So there's that pull. And what one of the things that we're doing in we-space practices, when we say let's learn how to do a better we, one of them is let's learn how to not regress when we get together. Let's learn how to make this we a transcendental we and not a mob, and not get caught in what Madison called the tyranny of the majority. Now, that hasn't been practiced a lot. Most human we practice is mob practice. And so even things like democracy are, you know, still trying to be figured out, because there are so many ways they can get pulled down into mob actions. So an integral we space is a space that has it and its and I, you know, present and having their impact. But you're also trying to take the we space among all of that and advance it, move it forward, make it more beautiful or more good or more truthful, more honest, more open, more transparent. And then, of course, learn ways to move into that unknown area. And those have to be trans-rhetorical. In many cases, they have to be transverbal. In some cases, they have to be transrational. And here, of course, is where we want to watch the pre-trans fallacy, because mm-hmm. that can always jump up. And it's one of the things that makes a mob.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those factors are there and implicit, but what we're doing is focusing on how to take that we out, that inner subjective nexus, and turn it into something that in most cases it hasn't been historically, which is that it could be a new Buddha. It never has been. But so why not? We're at a stage where individuals are able to include and appreciate every previous stage of development. That's never happened. That's radically new with second tier. So if that's new in an I space, then there's got to be something correlatively new in a we space. Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly what that is. We don't know exactly how to do that. Hell, we still don't know very well how to transform eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a lot more, you know, experience and practice and records. And so we have a lot more things we can, quote, teach people.
Mm-hmm.
But here in the we space, its initial stages are exploratory as much as anything. And so that's what makes them exciting and sometimes frustrating. And sometimes you hit on things, you know, that work well, and other times things that don't work well. And I think probably when Carrie first stood up and stopped talking third person and went into a kind of first person confessional stance, that was probably a pretty spooky moment for him.
Yeah, for sure.
And that took a lot of courage or stupidity, depending on how you want to look at it. Both can be helpful.
Those words aren't synonyms.
But now it's become, because we realize that there is a new space in eyes, that there's a new space in we's, And so that's what we're trying to figure out.
Jeff, I interrupted you. Do you want to return to what you were going to ask? Thank you, Ken.
Jeff?
Yeah? Jeff?
Maybe he's muted.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm muted, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's so right. We're learning. We have the questions right. We don't exactly know what we're doing. We're exploring our way into it. And there's some things that we can. I was intrigued by what you said about Lovinger, where groups and work two stages lower.
Yeah.
And so if you know, we're sort of tealish, you know, maybe bumping into turquoise from time to time, we're working as an integral as a group, often at orange and green, and that's actually quite true.
Yeah.
When I think of the integral groups, we're often doing that.
I know.
And that's just as interesting as a thought experiment, so thank you for that.
Yeah.
And I think that some of what we do is we work our way into integral is we see what doesn't work at those levels. And I think back in what you said a minute ago about trying to be a group without being individuals and how hard, impossible that is. But that's sort of the MO of green. When I think of the circles I sat in at Naropa, where they would be so deadened. And if anybody actually tried to rise up in any kind of vivid way, it would be like cutting yourself in front of Dracula. You would be immediately deconstructed by the group.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
So we don't want to do that.
That was my point when I said, you know, that the motives for saying the new Buddha will be the Sangha are very, very mixed. And in a large measure, they're nothing but green. And that's one of the problems, is how to make a we space that isn't green.
Right.
I would actually almost frame that as one of the central problems.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're exactly right. Green we spaces are deadening. And they are anti-creative and anti-novelty and anti-individuality and anti-holarchy. And it's nothing but a kind of systematic, everybody has to say what they're feeling.
That's where the individual does get to come forward in green. If you're crying, then we all have to stop.
Yeah,
you know?
That's true.
And that's what's kind of crazy, it's a little crazy making, you know.
Exactly.
So.
And so individuality is really looked on in almost demonic terms.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that is, but that's not an integral we. And so I think one of the things that when the excitement shows up and people feel that they're really on to something new and that this might even be a strange attractor for the world, I have virtually no doubt that when that happens, people are largely at second tier. And they are also tapping into subtler causal states, maybe even non-dual. And that's what makes those we spaces extraordinary. And we have to realize that those are going to be we spaces that most of the world are simply not going to get. You can't have an integral we space if you have somebody at first tier who, whenever they hear some other value, is going to roll their eyes. That, first of all, you can't generate trust that way. Nobody trusts anybody, and rightly so, because everybody at first tier is going to make fun of any other stage the first chance they get. So it's nothing but a bunch of eye-rolling contestants. And whatever kind of we space is going to be formed, well, they're out there all over the place, but they're not integral. And they're not causing the kind of excitement that some of these we practices are when they hit and are on the mark. So we're at that difficult position that integral has always been in, of being, you know, an elitism to which everybody is invited. But there is at least a component of certain requirements for adequacy. And that tends to go unsaid because it's politically incorrect.
Ken, that really begs a really important question for the Integral Living Room event that we're going to be doing soon, which is that since all of us are going to be people who function variously at different levels and we're not all consistently operating at turquoise or even teal, there are injunctions that can ask us all to fly a little higher and to draw ourselves into the orientations that can enable us to show up adequate to a higher level of space when we get together. And the praxis that I'm most aware of tend to be about what it takes for us to show up at a higher state. And because higher states are provocative turbochargers for higher stages, that seems like the thing I know best how to do, reminding people with pointing out instructions about relaxing into witnessing, orienting to the present moment, the kinds of things I mentioned earlier, that there's a kind of, maybe having some third-person framing before we go into the practices. All those things are really helpful.
Right.
But there may be some particular ways of setting the conditions that prevent that regression into a lower we space that you would want to point us to. And I'd be curious to hear any comments you have along those lines.
Injunctions and structures, just even the way you set a classroom style versus a circle versus time and using time frames. So I just want to broaden Terry's question to include structures as well.
Sure. I think what we're looking at is what can we do to help individuals come from both the highest state that they can come from and the highest structure that they can come from. And so many of the things that Terry mentioned are practices and injunctions for coming from causal and non-dual states. And those are all absolutely important and definitely deserve, a bit of a mention. And perhaps even, a little bit of introductory brief practice. But certainly surrendering into witnessing and at the minimum, non-dual awareness is even better, but it's harder to get people into. It's a little easier to talk individuals into an observing self, a witnessing self, than it is to talk people into getting rid of the looker entirely. And when you look at a table, there's just the table arising and no subject aware of it. It's the table sees itself. There's just a non-dual awareness. That can be a little trickier, but witnessing will do. But that's important for a higher state. And then, of course, present focused is central. And I would say those are at least two of the state injunctions that can be most useful in helping people get into causal or non-dual states. Little reminders like allowing the self-contraction to uncoil in the vast expanse of all space. Calling forth big mind. Any of those can help. And then for structures, there's one in particular that is, as far as I can tell, is actually an old Quaker practice. But it seems to be very effective. And that is, may the next words out of my mouth, and we keep repeating this throughout the evening, to ourselves anyway. Let the next words out of my mouth come from my highest self. And this is something that is said to the group, So you actually have a bit of a feedback mechanism of everybody looking to see, okay, what's your higher self going to say? And so there actually is a pressure to really dig deep or high, and certainly not, some idiotic red or amber structure. And so that can be very helpful, so that in addition to being present and witnessing, being possibly in big mind, the self-contraction uncoiled and relaxed, and surrendering into the present moment in that attitude of witnessing and letting come, is that when actual structures pass through your mind, select the one that in your best judgment comes from the highest part of you. And that can help at least orient structures towards the highest that the individual can find as they're looking for something to say. Now, you can also, at some point, and this just depends entirely on the type of we practice you're doing, you can start to try and make that slightly difficult, and not always to be sought after, but in some cases, the transition of trying to feel the inner subjective nexus as your highest self. Now, theoretically, that's a little bit off, but subjectively, that will tend to be how it feels. And the idea, of course, is that it's not really your highest self. It's your highest we. But you can get into a feeling of it and identifying with the network and opening to that higher we by actually trying to sort of feel it as an I, feel it as your own highest self, feel it as your own deepest being. And in a partial sense, that's true, because what everybody is ultimately expressing is the one true self or one big mind. But at some point, if that is what the we practice is going for, is a direct experience of a group intelligence, then you can translate that, let the next words out of my mouth be from my highest self, to let the next words out of my mouth be from this highest intelligence. And then that also has a kind of pressure on it to see, well, just how high is this intelligence, you know, that's being downloaded in you. That can be useful at that point. But simply let the next words out of my mouth be from my highest self, or let the next words out of my mouth be from big mind, however one wants to do it, can help to really notch up structures.
One of the things that I would like to also explore, because I think to the extent that we do it in the same way in our integral life practice, that we would do the spiritual dimension of the practice and we would work on, you know, the physicality, like we probably want to include some group physical practice together. I think in order to support the movement to big mind, we need a simultaneous collective shadow practice, so that there's a space in which the unintegrated parts of ourselves and the unspoken things and the seedier side of what goes on can actually get surfaced and made conscious, so that in a certain way, the more that we consciously let ourselves regress and really see it and own it, it kind of builds a platform for, to some degree, a more transcendent and certainly more highly integrated interpersonal interaction. So I think we probably want to include some collective shadow practice during the weekend as well. What are your thoughts on that, Ken?
Well, shadow practice is certainly part of any integral practice. And so if you're talking about an integral we, shadow elements are one of the elements that can most severely disrupt group trust and group enactment. And I often define the shadow as the locus of the lie. So it's also just a flat-out untruthfulness. And to the extent that it's really
right.
shadow,
yeah.
you know, the person doesn't know that they're being untruthful. That's the point. You lie, and then you forget it's a lie. You actually believe it. And so having that pointed out at some point could be a good idea. And I think we just have to be careful because it's also, it can be an almost endless process.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and it brings up a lot of, it can bring up a lot of defenses and put mm-hmm. people into an argumentative, defensive mode.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we do that, it might be better. I'm not saying we have to do it this way, but it might be better to discuss it in third terms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just invite people to apply it to themselves if they feel that it's appropriate,
mm-hmm.
and not actually get people engaged in mm-hmm. personal shadow confession and acknowledgement.
Right.
You know, some people will be willing to do that, and some people will get very, very defensive.
Yeah, and it may be that in my own practice, when the way that I generally work with it is we go along, and then the sort of, you might say, a marginalized opinion actually starts coming up. And you can start feeling it in the energy of the room, and you start feeling it affecting what's happening. And then usually at that
right.
point is the point where I just will start to name it. And then as we name it, we try to look at what the wisdom of it is, so
right.
that finding the wisdom kind of lowers the fear, the
right.
fear part of it. And that's something maybe we can do. Again, I think the point you're making is a good one, that unless people are skilled, it can sort of hijack group processes, and then people get afraid that conflict and shadow work is just the dominating discourse. But it really isn't about that. It's really about when it does start to arise in a group, to be able to ventilate or transmute it quickly is really the,
right.
Because in the past in our development, when things we were operating at a more dualistic level, then the way we worked with shadow was to exile and to cut something out and get rid of something. We don't seem really to be able to do that in the domains we're working in. So the question is, how can it be acknowledged and transmuted efficiently? I think that's a great distinction that you're making, because nobody wants to get bogged down in group conflict that never gets liberated. That makes
yeah.
sense.
Yeah, and particularly if something really does start to emerge that is starting to become obvious to a fair number of people and is actually kind of derailing the process,
yeah,
then
exactly.
I think, stopping and taking a moment to deal with that is definitely warranted.
Yeah. Okay, that was really clarifying for me. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, Ken, it's just occurring to me right now that we may talk about all kinds of different topics in the course of the Living Room event, but
yeah.
One of the things that's been reflected back to us is that there are two key questions that seem to be really upon people. One of them is the larger world crisis, the kind of question that I posed in my paper.
Right.
And the other is the big questions that affect us as a community, like in what ways can we
right.
as integral practitioners, as the integral community, evolve our community? In what
right.
ways are we going to sleep? What is our shadow? What, you know, such that we in our group practices can be dynamic in relation to the domain where we have more direct efficacy and influence.
Right.
And as you imagine us going into these, because in each case you could say we're venturing into inquiry or into these open-ended questions or koans, there's a potential for something real to be catalyzed, for something fruitful to emerge, for the
right.
exercise to bear real fruits and results that can make a difference. What do
right.
you think is the grounded and realistic hope? What would you find most exciting as we press into both those questions, kind of the global questions and then the more local questions of our own community?
Well, I think both of them are pressing issues, and there are, you know, landmines connected with both. The world crisis situation is, you know, ultimately, in many ways, it has directly to do with things that integral theory is itself directly concerned with. So one of them would be, for example, just the general development of altitude of items that are driving, you know, the world problems. I mean, if you have 70% of the world at ethnocentric or lower, you have zero chance for world peace. And so those all become directly important issues. And, you know, the questions are all, a lot of the answers are variations on how can you take virtually any dimension of the AQUA framework and make it larger, make it more inclusive, make it greater, increase the good or the true or the beautiful in any way that you possibly can. And one of the things that, if we go into that, one of the things that I would be bringing up is something that I think is important, and that is, just very briefly, if you look at, for example, the work on morphogenetic fields, and when you have a large protein that's just been synthesized, there are literally 1,000 ways that protein could fold. But once it folds into one way, and then another protein folds that way, and then another, pretty soon, that's the only way proteins will fold. And every time that protein is synthesized, it will immediately fold into that one way, and that way only. Now, we see this with any growth and development anywhere. When the red structure was first forming, it had to transcend and include its previous structures. But then within that, it could have formed in any number of ways. But as one way started to form and was repeated, then that came to be the one and only deep structure that red has. And so if you go anywhere in the world today and look at red, it's got an identical deep structure, and you can't change it. You can change surface structure, but not the deep structure. So where are those deep structures? Where do they exist? Where does any of the left-hand qualities exist? Where does mutual understanding exist, and so on? And so one of the points is that, back to the Whitehead tetraprehension, that every time a particular thought or feeling or emotion or idea comes up and you think about it, feel it, download it, or whatnot, you're adding to that structure wherever they're stored. The point is, you don't have to do anything but think it or feel it, and you are adding to that cumulative storehouse structure that the Lankavatara Sutra talks about, that they maintain is, you know, stored in the upper causal regions,
probably still nothing that something you can put your finger on or directly see, but simply thinking certain types of thoughts or activities, or simply thinking in an integral fashion, is actually stored in cosmic memory and will become part of a cosmic groove that is itself more integral. And so you can actually have an impact on world problems by thinking about them integrally, because those will be structures that are stored along with the folded protein and the deep structure of red and all the other structures that there are cosmic memories that form cosmic habits. And what happens, of course, when something actually comes to fruition is that some sort of majority of individuals are thinking in essentially similar ways. And then when that happens, you'll have a French or American Revolution, or you'll have the rise of environmentalism, or you'll have the rise of representative democracy, or so on. And so we're not wasting time just by going over integral approaches to these problems. Of course, it also helps if you then get, you know, politically involved and do stuff in the lower right. But that's often limited. And the point is that even if it is limited, there are things you can do to help problems become more solvable by being approached in more integral fashions. And that's by simply going over integral solutions in your own mind or discussing them with a group of people. So that's an important part of the tetraprehension of every moment. Every single thought, deed, feeling, and action we have is stored in the storehouse memory. And so it has an impact. It has an effect. And so it's not, and often you can't see it. So we have no idea the ways in which integral thinking is having an impact on the world. There's that statement you quoted that, you know, we're looking at miles, but, you know, moving in inches. We don't know how we're moving.
Right.
You know, there's just like that recent British government official report on climate adaptability, and it's like 500 pages long and had to go through massive peer review. And it's a judgment of the British capacity to meet climate change. And it's done with an aqua analysis. It uses quadrants, okay, levels, and lines, and names it that. And so that's now official British policy. So where did that come from? It's like it just dropped out of the blue. Well, it dropped out of the storehouse consciousness. And so we're seeing these kinds of things happen a lot. So, you know, continuing to discuss it and think about it and so on can have these kinds of powerful effects. So I think it's a good question in general, because it, you know, people want to know, well, how can, you know, what we're doing here have an actual impact on the real world? And of course, the obvious answers are, well, you can get involved in politics, or you can try to get political changes and so on. But there are other less obvious ways that help.
Mm-hmm.
And then as for how can we as a community move forward, that's a clearly an important question. It's also a very touchy question. And one of the reasons is that Jeff was saying earlier that a lot of what, you know, an integral group ends up doing is orange or green. And that's exactly right. And as we've seen a diversification of integral organizations, which on balance I think is great. But as you look at them all, you can't help but notice, you know, sort of the degree of greenness in some of them. On the one hand, others have a great deal of green allergy. And both of those are problems. And so whenever you are discussing that issue, it's hard. It's almost like discussing in public, you know, who's an enlightened spiritual teacher and who isn't. That can be a very delicate thing to get into. And it's the same with, you know, what as a community should we do? Since many of these different organizations have rather different ideas on what should be done and on what the main problem is. And a lot of these, I personally find, are just nowhere near second tier. And so all that does is, you know, irritate people. And so I find it hard to publicly comment on some of those issues. I don't know how y'all feel, but you know, any public discussion generally ends up being fairly, you know, generic about these issues.
Yeah, I would agree.
I do too. I think that's so well put.
And my own experience of kind of being in the integral community and imagining for a moment that the second tier in some dimension recapitulates first tier, you know, I would say that part of my experience is that we're unstable as a community in our own development. So, you know, at moments, one of us, myself, might function at quite a high level of development, but in the next moment feel threatened, or like I need to make more money, or suddenly these aren't the people I can work with, or whatever it happens to be. So there's a sort of a natural instability in terms of our level of development. And then I also think this thing about how it recapitulates first tier is that because we don't know, it's sort of like beige, you know, you're just trying to get sea legs, you know. We're trying to get our sea legs. So part of what I feel like I've experienced has been kind of a massive amount of prototyping, a lot of which has failed. And but there's something so deep and so genuine that while lots of models are failing, there is a coherence in our relationships and in our dedication to you, to the theory, and also to our own experience of what we might call integral consciousness, that in spite of these failures, we remain in community. So even though we don't have kind of whatever second-tier structures that might, we're not ready to recapitulate amber structures, but, you know, let's imagine turquoise recapitulates purple at some level, you know, there is a tribe, and that tribe is very loose, that I go to an event in Houston not expecting to see anybody, and 50 or 60 people show up who are all deeply involved in your work and who I saw 8 years ago there.
One of the problems is that I think as a community, we are expecting a little bit too much out of the community at this point in its evolution. Because we're talking right now about the fact that we really don't have a rule book on how to form an integral we. So how on earth would we have a rule book about how to form an integral organization?
Right, we don't know.
We don't. And so these integral organizations have about the same success rate, if you will, as various we practices do. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they hit, sometimes they miss. But none of them are, you know, absolutely firmly established. And there's dozens and dozens of different types of them. What they all have in common is a certain sort of framework and vocabulary. But there are so many different ways to take that we space. And what they all have in common is that they're driven by a new and higher series of I spaces. And so that's what makes it interesting.
Yeah.
But we also are still working on ways to transform people into second tier. In other words, ways to create integral eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, we have several different approaches, and many of them are promising and optimistic. But we still, you know, don't understand, particularly the developmental part, very well. Psychologists still don't know how people really transform. And so the number of practices that even conventional psychologists have created to develop people in their particular model is really pretty anemic. And yet, of course, it's a group of particularly intelligent people that got very excited by reading material that pointed out their own integral I space. And for the first time they felt like, you know, somebody was talking about where they were, and they recognized the territory they were at. And this was all exciting and very new. And so that was, you know, that was fun and that was great. But then how to carry that forward in all four quadrants is still a completely open question.
So people are holding the question in spite of the prototyping that is kind of, you know, doesn't endure necessarily. I'm very impressed by people's willingness to keep asking, which
right.
I think is worth a lot.
Well, and of course we have no option but to do that.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, whenever, you know, people find something that they know is good, they can't help but want to share it and get it out there and make it available and tell others about it and get others excited and so on. I mean, that's just, you know, something that we're, you know, just pretty much a course of action that, you know, we'll be on for some time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, Ken, the one gem, there are many, that comes out of this conversation for me is just the power of actually thinking about these things. Thank
right.
you for that.
Mm-hmm.
As somebody
yeah.
who's pretty good at thinking and not much else, that's very comforting.
Yeah, and talking, having the conversation,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's one of the things that we can remind people of at this event is that we're getting together and engaging this question together is we're putting grooves in the cosmos here.
Absolutely.
That are important and steering the ship. And
absolutely.
That relaxes me because then I don't feel, you know, there's so much of this in the integral world of we're tired of thinking about it and talking about it, we want to do something. It's like, okay, well, fine, but let's keep thinking and talking about it too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's all major historical moments were preceded by usually hundreds of years of thinking about it.
So true.
And, I mean, you know, it was from the Renaissance to the Enlightenment before representative democracy came into action. That wasn't something that somebody just thought of in a year or two later. They went out and had French and American revolutions. So we're still at that phase. And, you know, the demand for action and so on is fine, but it's also in many ways premature. And it also overlooks the storehouse cosmic grooves that we are creating the more we talk about it, the more we think about it. And, you know, just even conceiving issues in integral terms cuts a groove in the cosmos that will never go away, ever. And so that's an impact that you are having every single time you think integrally. That's a profound cut in the cosmos. It's an ontological reality. And that's what's so important. I think it's certainly one of the things that we would want to get across to people.
Right on.
I know we're close to the end of our time, but something occurs to me to ask you about in the midst of that conversation you just shared with Jeff, which is, you remember that section of my paper where I advocated for urgency.
Right.
And where I said that we don't really even try if we don't try to do it now. If we don't say, it's not like I'm going to do this because that'll create the conditions for something to happen later, and that'll, you know, that when we do that in some way, we don't take as seriously our intention to make a real difference immediately.
Right.
And that there's a value in contemplating crisis, because if we can take on the urgency of that situation without becoming contracted and losing our fundamental freedom and well-being and knowledge of the prior perfection of everything, if we can take it seriously and really go for it as if it matters and we have to do it now, a kind of quickening is in the field that can often bleed out. And
yeah,
as you were advocating the importance of building the integral worldview, the integral we space, the integral understandings, the kinds of things that took so long historically, but which are taking less and less time as we evolve.
Yeah.
It can seem to be an argument against urgency, and I know you hold both sides of that enduring polarity. Could you say something about how those two integrate with each other?
Sure. It all depends on seeing that thoughts are things. Thoughts have the same ontological reality as empirical objects. They're phenomena that arise in a real world space, whether that world space is magenta or red or amber or orange or teal or turquoise or indigo or violet or ultraviolet. Those world spaces are all as real as the sensory motor world space. And therefore the phenomena in them are as real as sensory motor phenomena. And therefore you can develop, if you see that, and get correct thinking on that issue, then there can be urgency about thinking, exactly as there can be urgency about objects in the sensory motor world. There's an urgency to think these things through in an integral fashion. And that is a thing. That is a real thing. And we are creating a thing that exists in a teal and turquoise world space as a real phenomena. And we don't have enough of that phenomena. We need more of it urgently. And that's why these conversations and these kinds of meetings and the type of writing that anybody does, the types of seminars that anybody does, are helping to create teal and turquoise objects, actual, ontologically real things. And those things are also just happen to be part of a list of items that are required to convert interior things into exterior things. So there was an urgency about individual freedom starting in the Renaissance. And the urgency originally was to make that thought a real thing, to realize it was a real reality that could be put into place in the real world. And it took a couple hundred years for that to happen. But the first person that said, oh, individual freedom is important, didn't go out and start a French Revolution. They would have gotten nowhere. The urgency was in thinking it through and populating the orange world with enough ontologically real phenomena about individual freedom that has started to spill over into the exterior world. And at that point, there was enough stuff to back actions in the sensorimotor world. And it wasn't that the actions in the sensorimotor world weren't urgent. They were, but so were the creating the internal objects. There was an urgency about that. And that actually had to happen before action in the exterior world could take place. Because otherwise people really had no idea what they were doing. And everybody had a different idea about individual freedom, and nobody would work together, and you couldn't create cohesive we spaces. And all of those just happened to be prerequisites of any sort of action in the lower right quadrant. And so there was an enormous, there was 200 years of urgency. And originally only a few people got the idea. And so it was a very small number of people that shared the ideas and started to form very small we groups. And then that went all the way up to things like the salons in the cafes of Paris. Mm. And the urgency to the dialogue continued. And as it did, it continued to build orange objects. And there were more and more and more of those. And more people started to realize that those were real realities. Those weren't, quote, just thoughts. Those were real phenomena in a real orange world space. And that not everything that was real was merely in the sensorimotor world. And there's this whole interior world that's just as real. In fact, in many cases, more real, because it has more depth. And so that's a type of urgency that if people understand that, whenever they are simply, quote, thinking about these things, they're actually creating real ontological objects that are being stored as cosmic grooves in the real cosmos. They would stop looking at it as mere thinking and start seeing it as actual building. And the more they realize they're actually building something, then they can do it with urgency and with passion and with awareness and with desire and with ragged truth-telling. They don't have to go out and start a revolution tomorrow. So I'm all in favor of urgency. I just want all objects to at least be put on equal footing in terms of the urgency of creating them, and then the urgency of sharing them and creating we spaces that are sharing those objects. And we're just getting to that.
Yeah.
And so until we at least have we spaces that with the same urgency as individuals had thought through turquoise objects, and then we get we spaces that are thinking intersubjectively about bringing we spaces into the world, then we have enough objects to carry into the sensorimotor world. And we'll be able to create lower right institutions that reflect those interior objects. And they are, as a matter of fact, simply their exterior correlates. But like I say, we're still at a bit early in evolution to even know how to get we spaces together reliably, let alone, therefore, how to go out and create an integral organization reliably. We still don't have rules for how to create integral business reliably. It's on a lot of people's minds, and that has to happen. They're building, in many cases, if you can call it that, integral orange objects. But that's what they're trying to do. And when they get a bundle of those cosmic grooves cut, then they'll have guidelines that they can carry into the actual sensory motor world of business and start to have an impact. But all of the meetings, and like John Mackey has just done his book on conscious capitalism, and it's a start. It's hardly the final word. And I would hate to see all of that put into action tomorrow urgently. But that would be a disaster. So we need more turquoise objects on conscious capitalism before we're going to really have enough faith in them to put them into law.
That's such an inspiring vision you just laid out, and in a way, it's a manifesto for the revolutionary impact of the work we're envisioning and intending to convene at the Integral Living Room. It's a beautiful expression. Thank you so much, Ken.
Excellent. I mean, that's what we've all been doing, and so, you know, to charge us with not taking action in this area is derelict. It's cruel and stupid. It can't happen without what all of you are doing. I'm dead serious.
Wow.
And thanks so much. We have so much to work with. We have so much to work with. It really is. We build this conversation we're going to be having is kind of warming up, and I just feel like we're already, you know, full on having the conversation that we want to have. So thanks so much, and we're really looking forward to seeing you in October in Boulder, and particularly when the basement is being cleaned up and all the water's been drained out and everyone's purified, and we're going to start again. So
okay,
thanks so much, Ken.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Di. Thank you, Jeff. It's great being on this call with all of you.
Let me know if there's anything, you know, further I can do.
Yeah, we'll be in touch.
We will.
Yeah, we definitely will be in touch, Ken.
Okay, great.
Bye-bye.
Much love, Ken. Bye-bye.